Hey, rock and roll bedheads, if you are anywhere near the Louisville, Kentucky area, that is, of course, where we call home, or if you are up for a road trip, come hang with us at one of our other crazy creations that I, Brian, have been involved with for years. It's called Louisville Loves Emo. This year, it happens December 7th, Saturday, December 7th. Louisville Loves Emo is the silly idea between me and another one of my friends where we said, what if we got all our musician pals together and we did our best to do full band live recreations of the songs that we grew up singing along to in the early 2000s? And then now we're 6 years later and Louisville Loves Emo is an experience. I don't even call it a concert. It's an experience. It's become a treasured communal thing in this area. We have a rotating cast of 20 to 30 musicians and performers who will play throughout the night, and they will hit those big emo anthems. And it's a big sing-along. I like to describe it as a house party. I'm there to host, but you'll get to see three live bands playing full sets with rotating guest vocalists, a DJ keeping the party atmosphere going. There'll be sing-along. There'll be live band karaoke, 8 to 11:30 p.m. It happens at my favorite place in the world besides my own house. That's Headliners Music Hall in Louisville, Kentucky. We'll put a link in the show notes. Tickets are just $18 in advance. Come hang Saturday, December 7th. And if you're coming from out of town, shoot us a note at wearethestoryguys@gmail.com, and we'll do a little rock and roll bedtime stories meetup, okay? We love you. Now let's do the show.
Don't go to sleep, mother. Don't go to sleep.
And do me a favor. Don't disturb my friend. He's dead tired.
Well, what the hell are you saying, Doss? You bruised half your body sleeping.
I sleep pretty hard.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
Hey, it's Brian.
And hey, it is Murdoch. It is Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories yet again. Hello, everyone.
On the docket today, another roundup of inquiries all circling around the same subject, but also, in this case, around the same era and genre. We're going to talk lead singer drama, specifically around a handful of bands from the early 2000s in like the modern rock scene. Some people might call this new metal. Some people might kick my ass for calling it new metal, including my friend Corey, who gets really mad when I refer to one of these bands as a new metal band. So I want to be careful about that. I don't want to offend any ideologies around what new metal is. We'll just call it early 2000s radio rock. That's really probably what it is.
Yeah, I like that too. Calling any of this new metal would offend me as well. But before we jump in, let's talk about that. Does it ever work to replace the frontman? I mean, there's been bands that where the singers get replaced and the bands maintain their level of success, or they fail, or it increases, right?
Are there somewhere at work? There are some that have increased. Give me an example.
Absolutely, and it's been everywhere lately because of a book release, and that's Van Halen. And as much as Alex Van Halen wants to throw shade and say that the band really lost like the original flavor and flame that was the original four, they sold way more records, if you want to look at it that way, with Hagar, because he wrote songs like love songs.
You're a Roth guy though, right?
Yeah, and I definitely like the early Van Halen better, but I saw both versions of them, and I definitely enjoyed the Dave.
Okay, well, Van Halen is a good example. AC/DC, I guess. Yeah. I got there too. So you have most of their success after they changed the lead singer. I mean, one that's a really interesting version of this is Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
But I don't know really how.
Band.
Yeah, it was kind of a different band, and it was a little bit that way with AC/DC. I mean, I guess the formula was the same, but they didn't really have, like, the thing about Van Halen is they have two distinct chapters. You know, they have a lot of success, and then there's a second amount of a lot of success, but they're kind of different because they have two different frontmen. Pink Floyd and AC/DC, they're not really fully off the ground until they switch lead singers.
And a friend of mine, he's a music nerd guy like me, and he posted the other day, he's like, if there's a band I could murder forever and never hear, it would be AC/DC. And I was sort of like, you know, man, they have a Bon Scott action figure, and there's a reason why.
Yeah, be careful what you say.
That band was definitely awesome with some weird sex appeal of that ugly man.
Well, and it's funny that you say that, because I have a close friend who one time started this discussion with me. I think we've talked about it on the show before, about like, what's the one band that you, if you just get a pass to just hate a band, who would you choose? And his is AC/DC. It's like the unpopular opinion thing. Mine is The Doors. And I know I've said that on the show before, and we've gotten letters about it, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to discuss it again today. What I'd rather discuss instead, all of this about lead singer replacement is a relevant discussion right now for some stuff that's happening. I mean, you mentioned the book release about Van Halen, but there's stuff happening in rock right now that I think is worth mentioning inside this conversation, specifically Linkin Park. I mean, there's a massive thing happening where they have decided to come back after Chester Bennington's death, after a 7-year hiatus, and they went and replaced him. And this is an interesting discussion too. I don't know how much time we want to spend on it, but I know from talking to you about this off the microphone that we have very different opinions. So yeah. This is a little bit of a point counterpoint, and I'll let you say what you think.
Sure. The Hollywood Bowl show that they did, like the last one they did without Chester and like the band sang all of Chester's parts, that should have been the last show. That should have been it.
All right. All right. Okay.
That's it.
I will answer that by saying this. I think and this is part of the discussion for today with all of these bands that we're going to look at and all of these letters we're going to answer, is that your response is a band as an idea and a band as an emotional outlet, right? Not it's a like, band as a business.
It's like Alice in Chains. They're clone Temple Pilots. Those were business decisions to keep those bands moving.
Right. And that's the thing that we're going to come back to this several times in this episode, but I just want to put it out there that if you have a mental block around hearing a band with a different lead singer, just remember the other guys in that band need a paycheck. All right. So we'll revisit this. Part of this brings us to the first letter, because not only is Linkin Park going through this lead singer replacement, there is something strange happening with this band, a quasi-contemporary of Linkin Park, called 3 Days Grace.
Yes, that because of this have a different name. This note is from Mal from Evanston, Illinois. She writes, "What is going on with 3 Days Grace? Did they rename themselves 3 Days Grace 2X?
I do think I actually saw them listed that way on the Sonic Temple Festival announcement.
Did you like them ever?
So here's the thing. I thought about this a lot after doing the research. I think this whole genre, because of my age, I very much am aware of and enjoy, and I enjoy the revival of it. At the time, I was clearly on the other side of the aisle in terms of how I liked the frustration in my music to be handled. This was the testosterone-driven side, and I was, as famously known, I was much more into the less testosterone, the emo side of it, right? I will say this. That song, I Hate Everything About You by 3 Days Grace, their big breakthrough hit, it's simplistic and it's stupid, and it is kind of undeniable as a rock and roll song.
I kind of put it in there with Green Jello. Like, it's just, to me, I can't, like, just can't get past it.
Did you know, hold on, did you know the Green Jello's in town next week?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I know. They should be playing with the Oakley Doakleys and whatever, the Sabbath, Max Sabbath. But I didn't like this band. This is just personal. It's like
this is age though. This is okay. So we bring this up on the show. There's a 9-year age gap, and there is stuff that you like from 9 years before this that probably doesn't register in my brain at all. And it's just because of when you went to college and high school and all that stuff.
Yeah. And when I left college, I moved to New York City. And when I was in New York, like I went and saw bands, but I wasn't getting introduced to like new music like I am now. And like I went out and danced at reggae clubs and did stuff. And then when I moved to Colorado, the funny thing for me, Brian, was that I thought I was going to jump back into radio when I moved into Colorado. And I was like, oh, my God, Britney Spears, NSYNC and Backstreet Boys. Like, I didn't know. Like, I was so like shielded from all of that.
Because of your time in New York.
For years. Yeah. Okay. I didn't know anything about any of that. And I was just stunned.
That's really funny. And you just missed. Like the Meet Me in the Bathroom era of New York. You were before that, right?
That's right. I saw the Yeah Yeah Yeahs once, but I didn't see the Strokes there.
Interesting. So. Yeah, so this is, I mean, and you kind of are alluding to it here, right? Like this energy is something that one of these bands now has a t-shirt that on the back of it says Divorce Dad Rock. And when I initially sent you the script, in our notes, for you to look over, I had labeled it Divorce Dad Rock episode. Like, I don't like that term because I think it is kind of mean-spirited, but there's a little bit to it, especially if one of the bands is going to claim it. And it's because if you listen to... this is what happens when we write an episode. I get down the wormhole. And so I start listening to these bands. Even if I haven't, I start listening to them out of curiosity, if nothing else. So, like, I know the hits here, but I was like, I want to hear what the new 3 Days Grace song sounds like. I want to hear what the new album sounds like. I listen to, like, half the new record. And these new songs, they're all, the energy is all very much like a simplistic, testosterone-fueled regret of a guy in his 40s. I mean, it is divorced dad rock. Like, it really very much is. And I don't mean that with any disrespect to anybody that loves these bands. Yeah. Because, you can always poke fun at anything, right? And that's not really my intention. But I do think that some of the energy that these guys bring is this, the world is a dark place. I've been a jerk. I want to be redeemed. It's this kind of stuff, right? There was a period of years back to 3 Days Grace where I thought I saw them open for Third Eye Blind, like right when they were coming up. I would have told you for a period of years that I saw them like in this very early period. And then for some reason, 10 years later or something, I saw a handbill from that show that I went to, and it wasn't them. It was like some local band from Tulsa. And this band is not from Tulsa.
No, those boys are not from Tulsa, Oklahoma. They're from Canada, eh?
So, a little background on this group, 3 Days Grace. Most of the band gets together early 90s when they're in high school. They hang on to that iteration for a while. They even put an album out in that iteration. And then there's a breakup and a reformation. And in 97, the new version of this is a guitarist and lead vocalist named Adam Gauthier, a drummer and backing vocalist named Neil Sanderson, and a bassist named Brad Walst.
Yeah, they become friends with this guy named Gavin Brown.
Shouts to Gavin Brown. He becomes a big deal, but they catch him early. And he does a lot in Canada. But he's done Lady Gaga and other stuff in recent years.
He takes years and years of their demos, right, and forms it into something that is worth showing people. And he takes it to EMI Music Publishing in Canada, eh?
And so this EMI in Canada, they're like, yeah, this sounds kind of good, eh? But we need something that sounds more like a hit. And so Gavin and the band go back into the studio, and they show back up and Hand of the Suits, a song called I Hate Everything About You. And now they have people paying attention, and they end up signing to Jive Records.
Yeah, surprising. It's the home of Timberlake, Britney Spears, and Chris Brown.
And this song is a huge hit, as I mentioned earlier. The band blows up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We have a lot to do today, so I'm just speeding the story up a little bit. But it feels important to point out that this lead singer I mentioned, Adam Gauthier, he very quickly, like in this first tour cycle, will develop an addiction to opiates. And he will end up in rehab. And he will then write songs about those addictions, including one that is called Animal I Become. And it will end up on the band's second record, and that follow-up record will also do quite well.
Adam takes it as a personal mission to be active in the recovery community and opens up about his recovery to other people. He plays free shows at treatment centers. There's a documentary about his struggles, too. He even relapses way later, and he'll openly talk about it. It's just an important thing about his life.
And so during this period, the band puts out 4 records, and they're getting ready to go on the road with Shinedown in 2013. And suddenly it breaks in the news that Adam has quit the band.
And I don't know if everyone has heard this before. The band will say the singer has health issues. And they have his blessing, the blessing, to continue without him. And the bass, I mean, this is great. The bass player's little brother will join the band as a lead singer, and his name is Matt Walst.
And Matt was, to his credit, I mean, yeah, we say little brother, like he just popped out of high school and was like, I can do it. But he had a band that had a minor hit in the years before this. And so he leaves that band and takes on this role in a much bigger band. And there's no official band story really on the real reason that Adam leaves. It's mostly just kind of brushed over in the narrative of this band. But I did find quite a few Redditors who have theories. And so we will at least entertain them for a moment. This is the show about rumor and innuendo. They all tend to point to like sort of the same normal band shit.
Yeah, if you look at the track listings, though, on the albums, there's a point where you see Adam's name less and less as a writer.
Right. That, you know, fans will point to that, right? Like, he's not getting to do as much in the band. They're also kind of changing their sound. They're getting a little more commercial. a little less dark. So the theory is that basically his creative input's getting squeezed out. He gets tired of it. And then over the years, comments have been made and pieces could be put together that make this look like there was a bit of a rift between him and the drummer, Neil Sanderson.
Yeah. So Adam does solo stuff. He starts a band with a guy from Stain. He's active, but never at the level he was when he was in 3 Days Grace.
And then, just a few weeks ago, in September of this year, 2024, weird things start happening. Adam's current band cancel dates. They go dark online. There's voicemails being leaked on social media where it sounds like Adam is talking to members of 3 Days Grace. And in early October, it's announced that Adam Gontier is rejoining 3 Days Grace.
But there's a kicker. No one is leaving the band. They're going to have two lead singers, hence 3 Days Grace 2X.
This is going to be really interesting to watch play out. I mean, we normally don't touch on things on the show like this that are happening in real time, but I don't know what the next few years for this band are going to be like. They're, like I mentioned, they've signed up for some major festivals. They're going to be very visible. We're going to get to see how this plays out. Do these guys sing just the songs that they sang in the band? You know, because there is this period of almost 10 years where Matt Walsh is the lead singer of 3 Days Grace, and there's like 3 or 4 records at least with his voice on them. So do they just trade back and forth? Do they do harmonies? I mean, what's that going to look like? And it'll be an interesting thing to watch. There's a version of this happening, and I was telling you this, I think, last week at some point, right, and you were like, I've never even heard of this. There's a version of this happening with an even lesser-known band, but I mean not an unknown band, named Anne Berlin from Florida, who's a band I've loved, you know that about me, for a very, very, very long time. I saw them on their first tour in like 2003, followed them religiously, saw them at Irving Plaza in New York right before the pandemic. I've seen them I don't know how many times. And a lot of the energy of that band revolves around a guy named Stephen Christian, and he in like 2014 or... it's a little unclear, but at some point about 10 years ago, the band decided they were going to call it quits, and it didn't last very long. They came back within a couple of years and started playing out again and doing dates, et cetera, et cetera. And this is where we come back to the band as a business thing. So what has broken now is that the other guys in the band want to make money being in a band. Steven has other ventures that he's doing in his personal life that are making money, and he has a family life and stuff he wants to attend to. So basically, he doesn't mind being in the band. There's no ill will. He doesn't mind recording. He doesn't want a tour. And so this band has just entered into a deal where they now, kind of like 3 Days Grace, have two singers, but they basically allow them both to do both things when they want to. And one of their lead singers, the other guy they have brought in with Steven, is a guy from a band called Memphis Mayfire named Matty Mullins. So he has a band that he tours with full-time as well, but then he does some tour dates with Anne Berlin. So they literally are just using two guys in the same role. And I can't think of a time that's ever been done in popular music. Can you?
No. I mean, has it?
I don't know. And that's, hit us up. We are the story guys at gmail.com. If you can think of an example of this we're missing in the moment, we might be. But if this works for them, it's excellent. It's a much better outcome than what you might expect, especially when you start digging into what we're going to be talking about today with some of these other bands. And for 3 Days Grace, it's, these other bands we're talking about are their contemporaries from the same time period, from 20 years ago. So if either of these situations work with Anne Berlin or 3 Days Grace, good for them. I think it's going to be something that we'll circle back to on this show at some point, though, because, it is a reinvention of the way this is done and the way people think about it. So
yeah,
let's go to our next letter and talk about another band in a similar situation from that same time period.
Yeah, I want to give a shout out to this fella because I'm super excited. This letter, I was like, what? We're going to talk about this? This is from Stacker in Fort Smith, Arkansas. Hey, there's a shout out to you,
Fort man. Smith, yeah.
I just saw a local venue that has booked Josie Scott from the rock band Saliva to play in a few weeks. It is being booked as Josie Scott Saliva. It's kind of like Stephen Piercy's Rat.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's exactly like that, yeah.
Yeah, except Stephen Piercy's worse. A friend of mine in El Paso just saw Saliva play there, and he said, Josie's not in the band, which used to be like Rat. There's no other Rat touring now, but this is now a Christian band? Question mark? What's happening is the letter from Stacker.
Oh, man, that's a lot to unpack. To add to this, I mean, we can put our own personal regional tint to it. So Saliva just played Louder Than Life Music Festival here, which, of course, we got to send a bunch of listeners to and attend ourselves. I just saw that one of my favorite music venues in town that holds about 400 people, you used to live down the street from it, literally, they just booked Josie Scott - the original voice of Saliva. That's how it's listed on the poster.
I love it. This band's really interesting. Their timeline's very similar, the time period of 3 Days Grace. But instead of for Canada, they're from my home state. They're from Memphis. And instead of being together for a long time in a high school band, they form out of the ashes of a bunch of bands.
Yeah, okay. So basically, even though none of them are that old, at the time, they all have a lot of experience when they come together. Josie Scott and Chris Diabaldo, they have another band that splits in the mid-90s. Josie starts putting something new together. He has Chris come see it. Chris is like, I want in. And now they're this new unit.
Yeah, and there's a guy respected in the scene who's like 7 or 10 years older than them. His name's Wayne Swimmy, and he joins the band too.
And in their infancy, they will cobble together a demo so that they can enter this Battle of the Bands type of contest that's being put on by the Grammys, of all things. They get really far in it, and then they lose. They are second place to Save Ferris in like 1995, yeah. Which right. is amazing to me that Saliva lost a Grammy contest to Save Ferris.
Yeah. Did you like Save Ferris?
Oh, Jesus Christ. Yeah, of course I did. It's a ska band with a chick. Like, did you?
Yeah. I just remember checking into it because, you know, how old I am, the reference. And I was like, this is pretty good. But I didn't have like a shelf life and I didn't stay with it. So I don't know anything about their career.
I mean, the main thing that they contributed to, you know, pop culture was their cover of Walking on Sunshine, right?
Right.
Isn't that them? Yeah. I mean, so, but it was always fun, and it was ska related, and I was very into ska. I don't know if we've ever really talked about that on the show, but I mean, I love it. So, yes, Save Ferris, shouts to them. Okay, back to Saliva. Because they basically cobble this demo together to join this contest, they'd only played like 6 shows, and they start to have A&R guys, record labels and stuff kind of sniffing around.
They didn't find immediate success. They play around a lot locally. They get recording an album and they actually put it out independently without a record label.
And it actually sells enough that they get a bunch of attention from different labels. They end up doing a bunch of showcases. Eventually, they take a deal with Island Def Jam, which again, we talked about Jive signing 3 Days Grace. This is again sort of a weird parallel. They end up on Island Def Jam.
Yeah. And that is how we eventually get Every 6 Seconds, which brings us some of the big hits and gets them included on the Fast and Furious soundtrack.
Much like everything, I Hate Everything About You by 3 Days Grace, Click Click Boom by Saliva is very stupid, but very undeniable. And it is built to be in a car chase movie.
Yeah. And guess who will write a song on Saliva's third record?
Oh, no.
That.
No.
Is Nikki Sixx.
Okay, after that record, they opened for Kiss and Aerosmith. So we're getting all your bands in here. And they end up getting huge. I think people forget how big Saliva got.
Yeah, and really, for me, how I felt like they got kind of big is that Josie had a hit without the band he did with Chad from Nickelback. It was Hero. And that was on the Spider-Man soundtrack.
And that's – okay, I'm glad you brought this up. This is a key point of this story that needs to be mentioned. Unlike Adam Gontier from 3 Days Grace or the band we're going to talk about next, Josie Scott gets a bunch of name recognition on his own. And that's important to this story, which you will see. Like – I mean, I think he had way more than people even remember. Yes, people forget how big Saliva was. They forget how big Josie was. Josie was on Jay-Z's The Blueprint. Like, that's a real thing that happened.
Yeah, weird.
And then he does TV. He starts acting a little bit. He's in a show on TNT called Wanted. He does Hustle and Flow, that movie that was pretty critically acclaimed with Terrence Howard.
Yeah, and he becomes more of a standalone celebrity, kind of, you know, not a A-lister, but one of the, you know, C-listers,
for sure.
Right? Than anyone else we're talking about in the episode today.
Okay, before we move on, because there haven't been enough rabbit trails and asides yet, quick nerdy aside about the Spider-Man song. So you mentioned that gets attributed to Chad Kroeger and Josie Scott. It's actually this weird one-off super group. So when they record it, it's those two guys and this dude from Theory of a Dead Man. And Matt Cameron from Pearl Jam is on it.
Yeah.
But even weirder, when they go to record the video, they decide to put that group in the video, which is also a weird choice because it seems expensive. But Matt Cameron can't record this day for some reason. I don't know, he had a soccer game to go to for his kids or something. And so Jeremy Taggart from Our Lady Peace is in the video as the drummer. He mimes right. the drums. I have no idea why you would do that. Why would you not just hire a session drummer or something? But anyway, again, I love Our Lady Peace. I don't know how much we've talked about that on the show. Love that band. Yeah. So this is a fun little aside.
The original guys in Saliva, it's Josie, Todd Poole, Dave Novotny, and guitarist Chris Diablo. Diabaldo, sorry. And Wayne Swinney. Todd Poole leaves before Every 6 Seconds hits, and then after the fourth record in 2004. Chris exits, and he kicks up some dust as he goes.
Yeah, he makes these weird statements that, like, the band's not a unit anymore. You know, just weird, vagary stuff, like vague book stuff. And then he apologizes and acts like he isn't leaving, and then he does leave.
And then it, you know, sort of looks like they kick him out. And it's funny because you can still Google this and see where there are headlines that says it's June 1st of 2005. And it says, Chris doesn't leave Saliva. And then June 2nd, 2005, Chris is leaving Saliva.
Yeah, they're never really clear about exactly what happens. And for years, it's pretty vague. It just seems like it was probably some interpersonal BS. Chris does this interview at the beginning of the year. Beginning of this year with Rhythm Section Podcast, which is a smaller show that I discovered that is delightful. It's clearly, I didn't look up these guys' accolades, but they're clearly like us. They're clearly old radio guys. They're in a great studio, and maybe they're currently on the radio, but they're in, like, outside of Memphis, and they're in on the Mississippi side. So they're covering, like, Mississippi musicians. And I guess a lot of these Saliva guys actually, like, lived in the area around Mississippi. And so they're getting all these guys on the show to just come in and talk about, like, what it was like to do stuff. And they get Chris Diabaldo to come in. And he does two episodes with them because they have so much fun. And I listen to both of them. And he says a couple of things were happening, right? He admits, A, that at this point, that record they had put out right at this, like, 2004, it's not performing. And so there's a lot of pressure all the way around the business of the band, back to this idea of business. Number two, he's just become a dad. And he says he's a little later to that than a lot of the other guys. And he's feeling the pressure of that. And then he will admit, and this is what I think the crux of it in the moment is that this Josie becoming a star is starting to stress people out. And the reason is because it affects everybody else in the band. Because if Josie's attention is on acting, and they said he said it was going to keep them off the road for up to 2 years. So you're looking at, you're not getting part of Josie's check. Josie's getting paid, but you're staying home and you're the bass player. And so when he quits, he says he immediately went and got a job, like, doing, like, construction.
Gosh.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it was, like, literally, like, he's like, I didn't want to do this anymore. So, yeah, they were on a conference call. They're on a band conference call. Things get heated, and he just quits. And then I guess came back, and then they were like, nah, you can be gone.
Three words that you would never put in a band name, Brian: band conference call. It's just, like, the worst band name.
You know, again, I know, but a band is a business, right? This is really the whole point of this episode, is that the band is a business. And when the band starts having to make business decisions, things get messy and they get weird for the fans. But you're talking about guys trying to bring home a paycheck, and this is what they've been doing for 10 or 12 or 20 years. So, yeah.
And this is how we started the episode, talking about that. But bands now are more transparent about when this happens. And when one of the unit no longer wants to do the thing, three or four people lose their jobs.
Yeah. I mean, and this is what's happening with Amber Lynn, right? Like, they have been very clear. And what's really interesting is this idea that right around now is podcasting's at a place where like normally a bunch of podcasts are not sources for our podcast. Like, we're typically digging through newspaper clippings and, you know, books and whatever else. But this particular subject matter is really fueled now. The knowledge behind it is fueled by all these interviews that people have gone on to rock-centered podcasts to talk about. So, you know, you've got Christy Abalo doing episodes of shows. You got Josie Scott doing interviews. And the Anne Berlin guys, when this all broke, Christian McElhaney from that band went on this and basically explained, we're a band. Three or four of us need a paycheck. Steven's doing other things to make money. He's wrecking the business. So we've come up with this agreement. And it's an interesting thing to see people be transparent about. But I, to your point, I don't think 20 years ago people were really explaining it this way. And people didn't really understand it this way.
No.
And what's ironic about all this is it only takes a few more years after Chris leaves where Josie quits. And this is the band he started. And the quote that I read was, we'd all been at the party too long.
Yeah, which is, sounds like a drag, really. The way that Josie talks about his own story is similar to how Chris talks about his now. And at that time, he was in, had a new kid also. And it was a rough, difficult delivery. And he realizes he's not healthy himself. He's on a lot of medications, so he steps away from everything to get healthy.
But here's the reason Stacker's confused, okay? This is why he sends the letter.
Yes.
When the band announces that Josie is leaving, they say that it is because he is going to pursue Christian music. And now, almost 15 years after the fact, you can go look, there is no Josie Scott solo Jesus record. It does not exist.
That's right. Here's what Josie says on that Battle Line podcast interview. He says, that was not the reason I left. That was just a good answer to give the press. I am a Christian, and I had explored doing a Christian solo record, but I basically was told there were a lot of snakes on that side of the fence, too.
Well, it's a really interesting quote.
It is.
And I read in other places where Josie said, like, he didn't even realize they were going to say that to the press. Like, he had a whole conversation with the band. And was like, I'm going to leave, blah, 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 blah. And like maybe, and he's like, I don't know, maybe in passing I said I might pursue Christian music. But like, I think someone within the band's camp felt like there needed to be a, like a reason instead of just a, like, we've been at the party too long reason. And so he's now, he's like on the hook for 15 years for this Christian record. So let's keep the light on the band Saliva for just a moment. Josie leaves. They hire a new guy. His name is Bobby Amaru. And now there are two original members left and a drummer who's been there for most of the time. Because if you remember, that first drummer leaves before they really get famous. And so three of these guys have been around for a long time. But over the next several years, they're less and less successful and everyone leaves and is replaced. Except for that original guitar player, the guy who was older than the rest of them, but was a legend. In one of the Chris Del Baldo interviews, he mentions that when he was a teenager, he would go sneak into clubs to watch Wayne play. And then he gets to become a bandmate with Wayne. And so Wayne sticks around, and he is the guy. He's the only original member of Saliva for years.
And Josie will go out. It's 2019 when he goes out as Josie Scott's Saliva. And then there's a one-off appearance at the Blue Ridge Rock Festival where Josie reunites with the band and sings some songs. That's in 2021, but otherwise Saliva has continued without him. And then on tour last year, Wayne has a brain hemorrhage and dies. So now there's no original members of the band. It's Saliva, not really.
So right after Wayne dies, Josie does this interview where they're asking him about Saliva and Wayne and all this stuff. Because Josie and Wayne went way back, obviously. They were original members. And he says, quote, I'm very close with Bobby Amaru, the new lead singer of Saliva. And I know in my heart and in my soul that Bobby will do the honorable thing. He never hasn't done the honorable thing. And I just trust in his steering the ship. And I know he's going to do the right thing. He says that three times. And I know it's all going to work out. It's all going to be great. What's that sound like to you? What do you think he thinks Bobby's going to do?
Make him money? I don't know. Oh, it's curious.
So I didn't understand any of this until I found this aforementioned podcast interview with Chris Diabaldo. In that interview, now, of course, this is just coming from Chris. But he does claim that now he is on good terms with Josie. And he says when he left the band, he and Josie didn't talk for like 7 years. Josie's kid who he had like been around as he was growing up. When Josie's kid graduates high school, he sends Chris Theobaldo an invitation to his graduation, and Chris shows up seated next to Josie, and they rekindle a friendship and have been great friends since then. And sad note, that kid of Josie's died during COVID.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So that's another piece. It's not really, it doesn't pertain to the story, but I think it's worth mentioning. So he says, this is what Chris says in this interview. He says that there was an agreement, and I cannot ascertain if this was a legal agreement or a verbal agreement between band members, but that they basically decided when people started falling off that the name would stay with the original members. So as long as there was an original member in the band, then mm-hmm. the band could be called Saliva. Now, like I said, Chris does not specify that this was ever written down or legally or made in a way in which it could be legally reinforced. But this was like what they thought was going to happen. So when I hear that quote from Josie from several years ago or from last year, I think what he's implying is, well, Bobby's going to give me the name. And now Saliva is a group of replacements.
Right.
And so the beginning of 2024, this is what he says. He says, I think Bobby will do the right thing. And then a month goes by.
Yeah. And then on February 5th, Josie posts a fully produced video on Facebook. It's in the show notes, that explains that he's going out as Josie Scott, the original voice of Saliva, basically, because it's the best way to honor himself while also honoring trademark law.
Yeah. So now we're back to the business of it all.
Yeah.
This kind of sucks for Josie. Like, I mean, I don't know, man. Where do you stand hearing that story?
It all feels gross. All money feels gross.
I mean,
it just feels gross.
This is, to me, this one's particularly weird because the band was so big and Josie was a part of all of the success. Like, they haven't had the Hagar period. Like, Bobby Amaru hasn't had 6 or 7 huge hits on modern rock radio. Those are all, so when people come to see Saliva, they come to hear Bobby Amaru sing Josie Scott songs. So it's a bummer to me that they play in front of thousands of people. I think they were main stage at Louder Than Life, which means you're automatically playing in front of like 20,000 people, while Josie's going to play in front of 400 if he's lucky on like a Thursday night in November.
Yeah.
I kind of want to go see Josie. Have you seen what he's doing on this tour?
No, I haven't.
He's like doing a lot of covers. Like, yeah, like Rage Against the Machine and stuff.
Oh, like those covers.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know, man. It's an interesting thing. Hopefully that will clear some things up for Stacker, though. Thank you for the letter. I don't think that's entirely over as an issue. Again, I think we might hear more about this in coming weeks and years. But let's move on to the final letter for today. Murdoch, read that one.
Yeah. Ashley, thanks for writing this letter. Ashley writes, what happened to Hinder and why did they sue their old lead singer?
Oh, man. What are your thoughts about Hinder?
Of all these bands, this is the one.
This is the one you like. And you know why? Right. You know why it's the one you like? It's the glam metal. It's the ripoff glam metal one of these bands.
This is the band I take home with me. Like these other two. Like, yeah, I take Hinder home with me, man.
Well, they were imaged entirely like that. If you saw pictures of them, if you saw the first album cover, it looked like a Warrant record, kind of. I mean, it was strange.
It was glammy. So we've talked about a Canadian band from Memphis. This third band comes from my place, which is my safe word, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And like, sorry, it's just funny. And like Saliva, they do a battle of the band sort of thing to grow a fan base. And they release some records, local scene, before they get big attention from, you know, kind of a bidding war with three labels. And they go with Super Big Monster when they go with Universal.
Yeah, so the Saliva story and the Hinder story are similar in a lot of ways. But one of them, is that they hit big time with that first major label record. Just like Every 6 Seconds was huge. Extreme Behavior, I think, is what the first record's called. Mm-hmm. And it's big. They're a little later, though. So Saliva's having that success in 01. Hinder finds it in like late 05, early 06. And so talk about the lead singer of this band.
His name's Austin Winkler. I love that his name is the same as Henry Winkler.
Not related. I did feel like, should I put that in the notes that they're not related?
Yeah. And he fits the Josie Scott mold in a lot of ways. He's an original member. He's got a lot of charisma, a lot of writing credits through the first four records. He doesn't become a standalone star like Josie does, but he's got some swagger that's perfect for that band.
Oh, yeah, totally. And he has those stereotypical rock star interests, or at least one of them, which is drugs. Read the headline from that Blabbermouth article that came out a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Or one year ago. I think it was just a year ago.
Yeah. Hey, Ashley, this one's for you. Ex-Hinder frontman Austin John Winkler went through 7 rehabs and 8 sober livings before achieving sobriety. None of this is funny, and we're not making fun of addiction. It's unbelievably difficult to get in and out of when you're trying to beat it. It's amazing that people can go through this so many times and beat it. But this is Austin John Winkler from Hinder. That's what happened to him.
So backing up a little bit.
He had to split, too.
2013 is when he steps away from the band to go to rehab. I don't know which time that is. But a few weeks later, the band will announce him, say he's officially out.
A quote from that article. The cumulative effect of his drinking and partying before, during, and after his time in Hinder led to the point where he was on dialysis for 9 months. He went on tour. He went for 4 or 5 hours. He went for 4 or 5 hours for 4 days a week on dialysis because of the drinking. He was fortunate enough to where he didn't have a liver transplant.
This is jarring stuff, and it all comes to a head in 2019. He describes literally turning yellow because his liver wasn't working right. I've never even heard of that.
Deep
and dark. Read that interview quote. You skipped that part.
Yeah. By the way, my dad used to he's kind of a little yellow. A little bit.
Really?
Yeah, definitely, for sure. Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, so here's that interview quote. I hadn't looked in the mirror, and the doctor was like, "Why are you so yellow?" And I had no clue I was yellow. It was not pretty towards the end. Like I said, just 2 shots, and that was just to keep me from shaking. So I can think that I was functioning. But, man, I thought that I had the cast of the House of 1,000 Corpses stalking me. The last month of me using was me waking up, having a couple of shots so I could just function. And then I would just peek around the room thinking that the guys were going to come and get me. Just full-blown paranoia.
I mean, this is awful stuff. So when he leaves the band, the rest of the guys, who I will say, unlike Saliva, don't really turn over. It stays pretty consistent, the guys in Hinder. They basically bring in this other guy who was extended family. So there is a guy who was, now he's not the little brother of the bass player like 3 Days Grace, but he's a guy who's been involved in making the albums and in writing stuff behind the scenes. He just never been on stage with them. And they're like, well, this guy's a perfect fit. So he can come in and do singer duties. So that's the choice they make.
Yeah. But let's get back to the reason that we're here, which is Ashley's question. Why was there a lawsuit?
Okay. So this happens before Austin hits the rock bottom period. This happens, so that's like 2019. This is a couple years before that. In 2017, there's a lawsuit. And this is another case of band as business and how these sorts of situations cause business problems. There's been some pretty good journalism about this, specifically by some Oklahoma newspapers. So pull back the curtain a little bit and read from that.
Yeah, and everyone, welcome to the terrible world of rock and roll business. I'm about to tell you, it's mundane, but it reveals that when he left the band, it was 2013, he signed something that's called a departure agreement.
And in this agreement, it stipulates a lot of specifics around how he will be able to interact with the name Hinder for the rest of his life. Like literally, and this is, I'm serious, how large it is allowed to be on a piece of paper when his name is also on the piece of paper.
Yeah. I mean, and when he booked dates on his own 2016, 2017, he was violating some of these rules. So that's when the band brought a suit against him.
And Hinder's attorney at the time will write this: Hinder has no ill will toward Mr. Winkler and would have much preferred to privately resolve this matter. Mr. Winkler, however, has apparently been uninterested in a solution like this, and though they've now been forced to seek legal redress, the band is less interested in a monetary reward, though, and more interested in protecting Hinder's valuable intellectual property and brand and reputation. So I guess this ultimately is effective, because there's not, if you go looking for information about this, you'll find the suit and not much about the resolution of the suit. And, you know, that club that you used to live next to has not booked Austin Winkler's Hinder recently. So I'm thinking that maybe they worked this out. I do think he's recording under his own name now. He's redone one of their hits as a country song. I mean, he's doing the stuff you do kind of when you're in this situation. And he is said to be celebrating sobriety. So, I mean, coming through those dark woods, hats off to this guy. He is he's clearly made of some tough stuff to get through that. It's a much happier ending than honestly I would have anticipated, having heard the setup.
So we have a time period and an era and kind of a genre. So what is it with this era of bands and their lead singer issues?
So I'm glad you're asking that, because I was thinking about this a lot during the research. And on one hand, like, initially my thought was that it's just this cluster in particular is a coincidence.
Right.
But on the other hand, I think there may be a broad argument, and again, this is very broad and unscientific, that this represents the last gasp of stereotypical rock stardom. Like, if you think about now, the cultural attitude towards things like general health and mental health is different than it was even 20 years ago. And audience segmentation and the major label bidding war type of stuff that you hear in all three of these stories doesn't exist anymore. And so when you take those things, when you take the major label bidding stuff and the big money, the big advances that can kind of allow you to spend money in a you know, crazy way that you're gonna have to pay back, when you take that and then you add in that now when bands go on tour, instead of staying out till 3 a.m drinking whiskey, they're often up at 5 a.m doing workouts together, it's a different culture and a different attitude. And so you don't see this burnout as much. I mean, again, you're always going to see some of it, but it is amazing, having worked in the backside of the industry with you. I mean, we used to see this, right? Like, we would be backstage, we would see big tours roll through, and you'd see the schedule. You'd see that these guys are doing workouts and that they're using the practice gym at the arena, and that they're, you know, it's not rolling in 5 minutes before the show with sunglasses on because you're so hungover, and then putting on a hell of a show and then going back and doing it again. That doesn't exist as much. And so I do wonder if this, and partly because of the genre encouraging it, because it being this flamboyant, and in the case of Hinder, as you pointed out, kind of glammy reemergence, if that might not be part of it. I mean, what do you think?
Well, I think it is interesting, your perspective, because I'm thinking about the decade before where I saw that decadence that was still happening. So those bands were getting advances and all of that.
Right. However, oh, yeah.
However, you know, I remember seeing Jonathan Fire Eater once, and they were like super hip kind of cult band. With kind of without them, we wouldn't have the Walkmen.
Well, they turn into the Walkmen, right?
Yeah. And they kind of are a predecessor of the Strokes.
Right.
And I went to see them, and I don't know how long it was, and the lead singer, gorgeous man, fell right off the stage. Uh-huh. The show's over. I remember asking, I was like, what happened? It was like, oh, your buddy sold him like a bottle of Xanax. So the things that you would see and happen with bands just excess all the time seemed to be more prevalent when I was in the 90s. And I would see them in clubs, and I would see bad shows, like bad arena shows. Yeah. And you don't hear
about that very often anymore.
No.
I mean, every once in a while, you'll hear about, Kings of Leon wasn't good, or Taking Back Sunday. I think we heard that at We Were Young. The guy was doing a weird vocal affectation. But that
Kings of Leon show is like 20 years ago.
Yeah. Which would fit this time period. You know who we didn't talk about, who might be interesting to just mention in passing here and could fit into a fourth part of this episode, is Shifty Shellshock and Crazy Town.
Yeah, and I thought about that too. Like as soon as you, like as soon as I started reading what you're putting back, like I could hear the song in my head.
Yeah, and he was maybe the most obvious and in the spotlight guy to kind of do this thing. Rest in peace, passed away a couple years ago, and it was the addiction. The addiction finally got him.
Yeah.
To bring it full circle, bad behavior from anybody in the band affects the whole band. Just like if you and I owned a burger joint and I was cooking meth in the kitchen, it would... You like how I cast myself as the meth cooker?
That was weird. Yeah, that's because you're a little skinny guy. Looks like you could be doing meth.
Hey, if you want to get involved in the show, it's wearethestoryguys@gmail.com. We obviously love your letters. We answered three of them on this episode. We also have a Patreon where you can support this bad habit of ours of spending late nights doing research and digging through music videos and listening to the new 3 Days Grace record. It's patreon.com/rockandrollbedtimestories and instagram.com/rockandrollbedtimestories. Tell your friends, leave a review, send an email, let people know about the show. It really helps us grow. And you can find a lot of studio videos and other things on YouTube as well if you search for Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories. Now, before we call it quits, there's one more thing we need to do. Murdoch, what should people keep doing until next time?
Come, my lady. Come, my lady. Keep telling stories.
Oh, Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories is a Story Guys production. The show is produced and edited by Brian Eichenberger. Get more stories, hear more podcasts, and book the guys for your conference or house party at wearethestoryguys.com. Copyright Boy Have We Got Stories Productions. All rights reserved.